or two, or even half a day for your letters, than run the risk of bringing on your cough again. Now, do not you feel that you had? Yes, I am sure you are much too reasonable. You look as if you would not do such a thing again.
Oh, she shall not do such a thing again. We will not allow her to do such a thing again. There must be some arrangement made. I shall speak to Mr. E. The man who fetches our letters every morning, one of our men, I forget his name, shall inquire for yours too and bring them to you. You are extremely kind, but I cannot give up my early walk. I am advised to be out of doors as much as I can. I must walk somewhere, and upon my word, I have scarcely ever had a bad morning before.
My dear Jane, say no more about it. I must only seek the concurrence of my lord and master. But I do flatter myself, my dear Jane, that my influence in that quarter is not entirely worn out. Then you may consider that point as settled.
Mrs. Weston, do not you think the post office a wonderful establishment? The regularity and dispatch of it. If one thinks of all that it has to do and all that it does so well, it really is astonishing.
It is certainly very well regulated.
So seldom that any negligence or blunder appears. So seldom that a letter, among the thousands that are constantly passing about the kingdom, is even carried wrong.
Yes.
Oh, Miss Woodhouse,
do not let me interrupt, I beg you.
Please join us. We are admiring the post office.
Are you indeed?
I am quite amazed at how so many letters reach their destination without a fault. And when one considers the variety of hands that are to be deciphered, it increases the wonder.
Isabella and Emma both write beautifully. They always have. But boys have very little teaching after an early age and scramble into any hand they can get.
I never saw any gentleman's handwriting.
Emma began, replying chiefly to Mrs. Weston, but stopped on perceiving that she was attending to someone else. Mrs. Weston was disengaged, and Emma addressed the group, which now also contained Mr. Knightley, who she knew thought little of her next subject, but so be it.
Mr. Frank Churchill writes one of the best gentlemen's hands I ever saw.
I do not admire it. It is too small, wants strength. It is like a woman's writing.
If we were in the other room, if I had my writing desk, I am sure I could produce a specimen. I have a note of his. Do not you remember, Mrs. Weston, employing him to write for you one day?
Well, well, I have that note, and can show it after dinner to convince Mr. Knightley.
When a gallant young man like Mr. Frank Churchill writes to a fair lady like Miss Woodhouse, he will, of course, put forth his best. Mr. Woodhouse, sir, are we to go through...
Yes, indeed. Dinner is on table. Mrs. Elton.
Jane's solicitude about fetching her own letters had not escaped Emma. She felt some curiosity to know whether the wet walk of this morning had produced any. She suspected that it had, that it would not have been so resolutely encountered but in full expectation of hearing from someone very dear, and that it had not been in vain. She thought there was an air of greater happiness than usual, a glow both of complexion and spirits. When the ladies returned to the drawing-room after dinner, Emma and Mrs. Weston were forced into a distinct party. With so much ill-behaviour did Mrs. Elton engross Jane Fairfax. Though much that passed between them was in a half-whisper, especially on Mrs. Elton's side, there was no avoiding a knowledge of their principal subjects. The post office, catching cold, fetching letters and friendship were long under discussion, and to them succeeded one, which must be at least equally unpleasant to Jane, inquiries whether she had yet heard of any situation likely to suit her, and professions of Mrs. Elton's most vigorous desire to assist.
I do get quite anxious about you, Jane. We must secure your situation. June will soon be here.
But I have never fixed on June or any other month, merely looked forward to the summer in general.
But have you really heard of nothing?
I have not even made any inquiry. I do not wish to make any yet.
Oh, my dear, we cannot begin too early. You are not aware of the difficulty of procuring exactly the desirable thing.
I'm not aware. Dear Mrs. Elton, who can have thought of it as I have done?
But you have not seen so much of the world as I have. You do not know how many candidates there always are for the first situations. I saw a vast deal of that in the neighbourhood around Maple Grove. A cousin of Mr. Suckling, Mrs. Bragg, had such an affinity of applications. Everybody was anxious to be in her family, for she moves in the first circle. Wax candles in the schoolroom. You may imagine how desirable. I shall write to Mrs. Partridge in a day or two and shall give her a strict charge to be on the lookout for anything eligible.
But Colonel and Mrs. Campbell are to be in town again by midsummer. I must spend some time with them. I am sure they will want it. Afterwards, I may probably be glad to dispose of myself. I would rather you did not mention the subject to your acquaintances till the time draws nearer.
But, my dear child, the time is drawing near.
Excuse me, ma'am, but I make no inquiry myself, and should be sorry to have any made by my friends. When I am quite determined as to the time, there are places in town, offices, where inquiry would soon produce something. Offices for the sale, not quite of human flesh, but of human intellect.
Oh, my dear, human flesh. You quite shock me. If you mean the slave trade, I assure you, Mr. Suckling was always rather a friend to the abolition.
I did not mean, I was not thinking of the slave trade. The governess trade, I assure you, was all that I had in view. Widely different, certainly, as to the guilt of those who carry it on. But I only mean to say that there are advertising offices, and that by applying to them, I should have no doubt of very soon meeting with something that would do.
Something that would do? Aye, that may suit your humble ideas of yourself. I know what a modest creature you are. But any commonplace situation will not satisfy your friends.
I am exceedingly obliged to you, Mrs. Elton. I am obliged to anybody who feels for me, but I am quite serious in wishing nothing to be done till the summer.
And I am quite serious too, I assure you, in resolving to be always on the watch. Ah, here come the gentlemen.
The whole party were but just reassembled in the drawing-room when Mr. Weston made his appearance among them. He had returned from London to a late dinner and walked to Hartfield as soon as it was over. He was excited, happy and cheerful as usual, and with all the right of being principal talker which a day spent anywhere from home confers, was making himself agreeable among the rest, and having spread abroad what public news he had heard, was proceeding to a family communication which, though principally addressed to Mrs. Weston, he knew it would be highly interesting to everybody in the room. He gave her a letter. It was from Frank and to herself. He had met with it in his way and had taken the liberty of opening it. Mrs. Weston and Emma looked over it together, and he sat smiling and talking to them the whole time, in a voice a little subdued, but very audible to everybody.
Well, he is coming, you see. Good news, I think. Well, what do you say to it? I always told you he would be here again soon, did not I? In town next week, you see, at the latest, I dare say. For she is so impatient. Most likely they will be there tomorrow or Saturday. As to her illness, all nothing, of course. But it is an excellent thing to have Frank among us again, so near as town. They will stay a good while when they do come, and he will be half his time with us. This is precisely what I wanted.
Mrs. Weston was most comfortably pleased on the occasion. Her looks and words had nothing to restrain them. Her congratulations were warm and open, but Emma could not speak so fluently. She was a little occupied in weighing her own feelings and trying to understand the degree of her agitation, which she rather thought was considerable. Mr. Weston, however, too eager to be very observant, too communicative to want others to talk, was very well satisfied with what she did say, and soon moved away to make the rest of his friends happy by a partial communication of what the whole room must have overheard already. It was well that he took everybody's joy for granted, or he might not have thought either Mr. Woodhouse or Mr. Knightley particularly delighted. From them he would have proceeded to Miss Fairfax, but she was so deep in conversation with John Knightley that it would have been too positive an interruption, and finding himself close to Mrs. Elton and her attention disengaged, he necessarily began on the subject with her.
I hope I shall soon have the pleasure of introducing my son to you. You have heard of a certain Frank Churchill, I presume, and know him to be my son, though he does not bear my name.
Oh, yes, and I shall be very happy in his acquaintance. I am sure Mr. Elton will lose no time in calling on him, and we shall both have great pleasure in seeing him at the vicarage.
You are very obliging. Frank will be extremely happy, I'm sure. He is to be in town next week, if not sooner. We have notice of it in a letter today. Their journey is on Mrs. Churchill's account. She has not been well the whole winter and thinks Enscombe too cold for her. So they are all to move southward without loss of time. Mrs. Churchill is not much in my good graces, but this is quite between ourselves. I would not say so to everybody, Mrs. Elton, but I have not much faith in Mrs. Churchill's illness. The fact is, I suppose, that she is tired of Enscombe. It is a retired place. A fine place, but very retired.
Aye, like Maple Grove, I dare say. Nothing can be more retired than Maple Grove. Perhaps Mrs. Churchill does not have resources enough in herself to be qualified for a country life. I always say a woman cannot have too many resources, and I feel very thankful that I have so many myself as to be quite independent of society.
But I did not mention the length of Frank's stay. We have the agreeable prospect of frequent visits from Frank the whole spring, for Mrs. Churchill is intent on being in London for the whole of May. I hope you will be pleased with my son, but you must not expect a prodigy.
I assure you, Mr. Weston, I have very little doubt that my opinion will be decidedly in his favour.
I hope I have not been severe upon poor Mrs. Churchill. If she is ill, I should be sorry to do her injustice, but there are some traits in her character which make it difficult for me to speak of her with the forbearance I could wish. She was nobody when Mr. Churchill married her, barely the daughter of a gentleman. But ever since her being turned into a Churchill, she has out-Churchilled them all in high and mighty claims. But in herself, I assure you, she is an upstart.
Only think. Well, that must be infinitely provoking. I have quite a horror of upstarts. Maple Grove has given me a thorough disgust to people of that sort. For there is a family in that neighbourhood who are such an annoyance to my brother and sister from the airs they give themselves.
They were interrupted. Tea was carrying round, and Mr. Weston, having said all that he wanted, soon took the opportunity of walking away. After tea, the party was divided into one group playing cards and a few scattered groups in conversation. Emma was seated beside the Mr. Knightleys. Mr. John Knightley proved more talkative than his brother on account of him leaving his sons tomorrow for a stay of a few weeks at Hartfield.
Well, Emma, I do not believe I have anything more to say about the boys. Only do not spoil them and do not physic them.
You need not fear it. I shall do all in my power to make them happy.
And if you find them troublesome, you must send them home again. They may be too noisy for your father, or even maybe some encumbrance to you, if your visiting engagements continue to increase as much as they have done lately.
Increase? These amazing engagements of mine, what have they been? Dining once with the Coles and having a ball talked of which never took place.
Still, there can be no doubt of your being much more engaged with company than you used to be. It is very possible, therefore, that Henry and John may sometimes be in the way. And if they are, I only beg you to send them home.
No, my dear brother, that need not be the consequence. Let them be sent to Donwell. I shall certainly be at leisure.
I must say that if Aunt Emma has not time for them, I do not think they would fare much better with Uncle Knightley, who is absent from home about 5 hours where she is absent one, and who, when he is at home, is either reading to himself or settling his accounts.
Mr. Knightley seemed to be trying not to smile, and succeeded without difficulty upon Mrs. Elton's beginning to talk to him. A very little quiet reflection was enough to satisfy Emma as to the nature of her agitation on hearing the news of Frank Churchill's return. She was soon convinced that it was not for herself she was feeling at all apprehensive or embarrassed. It was for him. Her own attachment had really subsided into a mere nothing. It was not worth thinking of. But if he, who had undoubtedly been the most in love of the two, were to be returning with the same warmth of sentiment which he had taken away, it would be very distressing. If a separation of 2 months should not have cooled him, there were dangers and evils before her. Caution for him and for herself would be necessary. She did not mean to have her own affections entangled again, and it would be incumbent on her to avoid any encouragement of his. She wished she might be able to keep him from an absolute declaration. That would be so very painful a conclusion of their present acquaintance. And yet she could not help rather anticipating something decisive. She felt as if the spring would not pass without bringing a crisis, an event, a something to alter her present composed and tranquil state. It was not very long, though rather longer than Mr. Weston had foreseen, before she had the power of forming some opinion of Frank Churchill's feelings. The Enscombe family were not in town quite so soon as had been imagined, but Frank was at Highbury very soon afterwards. He rode down for a couple of hours. He could not yet do more, but he came from Randalls immediately to Hartfield, and they met with the utmost friendliness. There could be no doubt of his great pleasure in seeing her, but she had an almost instant doubt of his caring for her as he had done, of his feeling the same tenderness in the same degree. Absence, with the conviction probably of her indifference, had produced this very natural and very desirable effect. He was in high spirits, but his spirits were evidently fluttered. There was restlessness about him, which is what signified to Emma's mind his comparative difference.
I have often thought of Hartfield while in town. Highbury, all in all, of course, but Hartfield is such a contented place. One is always certain of such a warm welcome. Everybody says so. And I assure them it is the Woodhouses that bring all the warmth to this charming house, like a good fire.
A fire, indeed.
Aye, a steady fire that is ever renewed and never allowed to fall to ash. Enough of my nonsense. Tell me, is everybody well?
We are all well, I thank you. We are glad of spring arriving, Papa especially, for removing the evil of the damp we had earlier in the year. Harriet is very well, though I think you will not see her on so short a visit.
Alas, no. I am sorry for it. Indeed, I fear I must take my leave even of you, Miss Woodhouse. I saw a group of old acquaintance in the street as I passed. I had not stopped. I would not stop for more than a word. But I have the vanity to think they will be disappointed if I do not call. Much as I wish to stay longer at Hartfield, I must hurry off.
Emma was left in no doubt as to his being less in love, but she was rather inclined to think his hurrying away implied a dread of her returning power and a discreet resolution of not trusting himself with her long. This was the only visit from Frank Churchill in the course of 10 days. He was often hoping, intending to come, but was always prevented. His aunt could not bear to have him leave her. London was not the place for her. She could not endure its noise. Her nerves were under continual irritation and suffering, and by the 10 days' end, her nephew's letter to Randalls communicated a change of plan, which Mr. Weston relayed to Emma during a morning visit to Hartfield.
They are going to remove immediately to Richmond. Mrs. Churchill has been recommended to the medical skill of an eminent person there, and had otherwise a fancy for the place.
Oh, that is happy news for Randalls indeed, Mr. Weston.
For us all, Emma, for us all. They have found a ready furnished house in a favourite spot, and much benefit is expected from the change. He is in the highest spirits, Miss Woodhouse. The house is taken for May and June. Frank wrote with the greatest confidence of being often with us, almost as often as even he could wish. Now it will be really like having Frank in our neighbourhood. What are 9 miles to a young man? An hour's ride? Half the distance as to London? He will be always coming over. Richmond is the very distance for easy intercourse.
With this news, one good thing was immediately brought to a certainty. The ball at the Crown. every preparation was resumed, and very soon after the Churchills had removed to Richmond, a few lines from Frank to say that his aunt felt already much better for the change, and that he had no doubt of being able to join them for 24 hours at any given time, induced them to name as early a day as possible. Mr. Weston's ball was to be a real thing. A very few tomorrows stood between the young people of Highbury and happiness. Mr. Woodhouse was resigned. The time of year lightened the evil to him. May was better for everything than February. No misfortune occurred again to prevent the ball. The day approached, the day arrived, and after a morning of some anxious watching, Frank Churchill, in all the certainty of his own self, reached Randall's before dinner, and everything was safe. No second meeting had there yet been between him and Emma. The room at the Crown was to witness it. She was to convey Harriet, and they drove to the Crown in good time, the Randall's party just sufficiently before them.
Miss Woodhouse, Miss Smith, good evening, dear ladies.
Good evening, Mr. Weston.
Well, Emma, what think you of the room? Is it well done?
Beautifully done.
Mrs. Weston is owed the credit, of course.
Frank was a great help, it must be said.
I was only executing your vision, Mrs. Weston. I'm sure every guest will admire it. I think Mrs. Elton must be here soon. I have a great curiosity to see her after so much talk. It cannot be long, I think, before she comes. Perhaps I can see her in... Oh, but I'm forgetting that I'm not acquainted with her. I have never seen either Mr. or Mrs. Elton. I have no business to put myself forward.
Mr. and Mrs. Elton appeared, and all the smiles and the proprieties passed. The party, in total, was large, with Mr. Weston's cousins and acquaintances adding to the usual groups from Randall's and Hartfield. Two of the party, however, were yet missing, Miss Bates and Miss Fairfax, who had not been collected by the Westons because were expected to be brought by the Eltons, who had forgotten the promise. The mistake had been slight. The carriage was sent for them now. Emma longed to know what Frank's first opinion of Mrs. Elton might be. He was immediately qualifying himself to form an opinion by giving her very proper attention after the introduction had passed. In a few minutes, the carriage returned. Somebody talked of rain, and Frank sought an umbrella to see the ladies in safely. Mrs. Elton turned to address Mrs. Weston.
I have no doubt of its being our carriage with Miss Bates and Jane. Our coachman and horses are so extremely expeditious. What a pleasure it is to send one's carriage for a friend. I understand you were so kind as to offer, Mrs. Weston, but another time it will be quite unnecessary. You may be very sure I shall always take care of them. Ah, here they are. Miss Bates at the helm, of course.
Well, this is brilliant indeed. This is admirable. Excellently contrived, upon my word. Nothing wanting. Could not have imagined it. So well lighted up. Jane, look. Did you ever see anything? Oh, Mr. Weston, you must really have had Aladdin's lamp.
Come, please join the circle by the fire here.
Welcome, dear ladies. Miss Bates, I do hope...
Dear Mrs. Elton, so obliged to you for the carriage. Excellent time. Jane and I, quite ready. Did not keep the horses a moment. Most comfortable carriage. Oh, and I am sure our thanks are due to you, Mrs. Weston, on that score. Mrs. Elton had most kindly sent Jane a note, or we should have come with you. But two such offers in one day. Never were such neighbours. My dear Jane, are you sure you did not wet your feet? It was but a drop or two, but I am so afraid. But Mr. Frank Churchill was so extremely... And there was a mat to step upon. I shall never forget his extreme politeness. Ah, here's Miss Woodhouse. Dear Miss Woodhouse, how do you do? This is meeting quite in fairyland. Such a transformation and such a noble fire. I am quite roasted.
Frank Churchill returned to his station by Emma, and as soon as Miss Bates was quiet, they found themselves necessarily overhearing the discourse of Mrs. Elton and Miss Fairfax, who were standing a little way behind. After a good many compliments to Jane on her dress and look, Mrs. Elton was evidently wanting to be complimented herself.
How do you like my gown?
It is extremely elegant.
How has Wright done my hair?
Perfectly, madam.
Well, nobody can think less of dress in general than I do, Jane, but upon such an occasion as this, when everybody's eyes are so much upon me and in compliment to the Westons, who I have no doubt are giving this ball chiefly to do me honour, I would not wish to...
Well, how do you like Mrs. Elton?
Not at all, Miss Woodhouse. Not at all.
You are ungrateful.
Ungrateful? What do you mean? No, do not tell me. I do not want to know what you mean. Where is my father? When are we to begin dancing?
Emma could hardly understand him this evening. He seemed in an odd humour. He walked off to find his father, but was quickly back again with both Mr. and Mrs. Weston. He had met with them in a little perplexity, which must be laid before Emma. It had just occurred to Mrs. Weston that Mrs. Elton must be asked to begin the ball, that she would expect it, which interfered with all their wishes of giving Emma that distinction. Emma heard the sad truth with fortitude.
And what are we to do for a proper partner for her? She will think Frank ought to ask her.
Father, I must politely refuse such talk, for I have long since promised this dance. Perhaps you may begin with Mrs. Elton, and Miss Woodhouse and I shall follow.
Did I hear my name?
Mrs. Elton. Good, madam. You did indeed. Would you do me the honour, the double honour, of joining me for the first dance and beginning the ball?
Oh, Mr. Weston, I should be delighted.
Then allow me to escort you to the top of the room.
Leading the way again. Such a compliment. I would not have imagined, though.
Miss Woodhouse, may I have the honour?
Certainly, Mr. Churchill.
Emma must submit to stand second to Mrs. Elton, though she had always considered the ball as peculiarly for her. It was almost enough to make her think of marrying. In spite of this little rub, however, Emma was smiling with enjoyment, delighted to see the respectable length of the set as it was forming, and to feel that she had so many hours of unusual festivity before her. She was more disturbed by Mr. Knightley's not dancing than by anything else. There he was, among the standers-by, where he ought not to be. He ought to be dancing, not classing himself with the husbands and fathers and whist-players, so young as he looked. He could not have appeared to greater advantage, perhaps anywhere, than where he had placed himself. His tall, firm, upright figure, among the bulky forms and stooping shoulders of the elderly men, was such as Emma felt must draw everybody's eyes, and excepting her own partner, there was not one among the whole row of young men who could be compared with him. It was her own partner who withdrew her from her thoughts.
Are you quite ready, Miss Woodhouse?
Yes, of course.
A lively beginning. Will you keep up, Miss Woodhouse?
It is you who will need to keep up with me, Mr. Churchill.
I shall hold you to that.
Emma could not help but reflect that they were a handsome couple and felt much observed as they danced the length of the room. When they reached the top of the room once more, she saw Mr. Knightley had still not joined the set. He only moved a few steps nearer, and those few steps were enough to prove in how gentlemanlike a manner, with what natural grace he must have danced, would he but take the trouble. He remained near the dancing, however, and seemed often observing her. She must not flatter herself that he thought of her dancing, but if he were criticizing her behavior, she did not feel afraid. There was nothing like flirtation between her and her partner. They seemed more like cheerful, easy friends than lovers. That Frank Churchill thought less of her than he had done was indubitable. The two last dances before supper were begun, and Emma saw that Harriet had no partner. She was the only young lady sitting down, and so equal had been hitherto the number of dancers that how there could be anyone disengaged was the wonder. But Emma's wonder lessened soon afterwards on seeing Mr. Elton sauntering about. He would not ask Harriet to dance if it were possible to be avoided. She was sure he would not. And she was expecting him every moment to escape into the card room. Escape, however, was not his plan. he came to the part of the room where the sitters-by were collected, spoke to some, and walked about in front of them as if to show his liberty and his resolution of maintaining it. Emma saw it. She was not yet dancing. She was working her way up from the bottom of the set and had therefore leisure to look around. When she was halfway up the set, Mr. Elton was so near that she heard every syllable of a dialogue which just then took place between him and Mrs. Weston, and perceived that his wife, who was standing immediately above her, was encouraging him by significant glances. The kind-hearted, gentle Mrs. Weston had left her seat to join him and try to improve the situation.
Do not you dance, Mr. Elton?
Most readily, Mrs. Weston, if you will dance with me.
Me? Oh, no. I would get you a better partner than myself. I am no dancer.
If Mrs. Gilbert wishes to dance, I shall have great pleasure, I am sure, for though beginning to feel myself rather an old married man and that my dancing days are over, it would give me great pleasure at any time to stand up with an old friend like Mrs. Gilbert.
Mrs. Gilbert does not mean to dance, but there is a young lady disengaged whom I should be very glad to see dancing. Miss Smith?
Miss Smith? Oh, I had not observed. You are extremely obliging, and if I were not an old married man, but my dancing days are over, Mrs. Weston, you will excuse me. Anything else I should be most happy to do at your command, but my dancing days are over.
Mrs. Weston said no more, and Emma could imagine with what surprise and mortification she must be returning to her seat. This was Mr. Elton, the amiable, obliging, gentle Mr. Elton. She looked round for a moment. He was arranging himself at a little distance, while smiles of high glee passed between him and his wife. She would not look again. Her heart was in a glow, and she feared her face might be as hot. In another moment, a happier sight caught her. Mr. Knightley leading Harriet to the set. Never had she been more surprised, seldom more delighted than at that instant. His dancing proved to be just what she had believed it, extremely good, and Harriet would have seemed almost too lucky if it had not been for the cruel state of things before, and for the very complete enjoyment and the very high sense of the distinction which her happy features announced. It was not thrown away on her. She bounded higher than ever, flew farther down the middle, and was in a continual course of smiles. With the first dances over, supper was announced. The move began, and Miss Bates might be heard from that moment without interruption till her being seated at table and taking up her spoon. Emma had no opportunity of speaking to Mr. Knightley till after supper, but when they were all in the ballroom again, her eyes invited him irresistibly to come to her and be thanked. He was warm in his reprobation of Mr. Elton's conduct. It had been unpardonable rudeness, and Mrs. Elton's looks also received the due share of censure.
She aimed at wounding more than Harriet. Emma, why is it that they are your enemies? Mrs. Elton ought not to be angry with you, I suspect, whatever he may be. To that surmise you say nothing, of course. But confess, Emma, that you did want him to marry Harriet.
I did. And they cannot forgive me.
I shall not scold you. I leave you to your own reflections.
Can you trust me with such flatterers? Does my vain spirit ever tell me I am wrong?
Not your vain spirit, but your serious spirit. If one leads you wrong, I'm sure the other tells you of it.
I do own myself to have been completely mistaken in Mr. Elton. There is a littleness about him which you discovered and which I did not. And I was fully convinced of his being in love with Harriet. It was through a series of strange blunders.
No. In return for your acknowledging so much, I will do you the justice to say that you would have chosen for him better than he has chosen for himself. Harriet Smith has some first-rate qualities which Mrs. Elton is totally without. An unpretending, single-minded, artless girl, infinitely to be preferred by any man of sense and taste to such a woman as Mrs. Elton. I found Harriet more conversable than I expected.
Miss Otway.
Look out. Mrs. Weston is hunting for dancers.
Come, Emma. Set your companions the example. Everybody is lazy. Everybody is lazy.
Everybody is asleep.
I am ready whenever I am wanted.
Whom are you going to dance with?
With you, if you will ask me.
Will you?
Indeed I will. You have shown that you can dance, and you know we are not really so much brother and sister as to make it at all improper.
Brother and sister? No, indeed.
This little explanation with Mr. Knightley gave Emma considerable pleasure. It was one of the agreeable recollections of the ball, which she walked about the lawn the next morning to enjoy. She was extremely glad that they had come to so good an understanding respecting the Eltons, and that their opinions of both husband and wife were so much alike, and his praise of Harriet, his concession in her favour, was peculiarly gratifying. The impertinence of the Eltons, which for a few minutes had threatened to ruin the rest of her evening, had been the occasion of some of its highest satisfactions, and she looked forward to another happy result, the cure of Harriet's infatuation. From Harriet's manner of speaking of the circumstance before they quitted the ballroom, she had strong hopes. It seemed as if her eyes were suddenly opened, and she were enabled to see that Mr. Elton was not the superior creature she had believed him. The fever was over, and Emma could harbour little fear of the pulse being quickened again by injurious courtesy. Harriet rational, Frank Churchill not too much in love, and Mr. Knightley not wanting to quarrel with her. How very happy a summer must be before her. She was not to see Frank Churchill this morning. He had told her that he could not allow himself the pleasure of stopping at Hartfield, as he was to be at home by the middle of the day. She did not regret it. Having arranged all these matters, looked them through, and put them all to rights, she was just turning to the house with spirits freshened up for the demands of the two little boys, as well as of their grandpapa, when the great iron sweep gate opened and two persons entered whom she had never less expected to see together. Frank Churchill, with Harriet leaning on his arm, actually Harriet. A moment sufficed to convince her that something extraordinary had happened. Harriet looked white and frightened, and he was trying to cheer her. Emma dashed over to them.
Harriet! Mr. Churchill, what happened?
We must get her inside. She has had quite a shock.
Oh, come into the hall.
Emma rushed up the steps and opened the door. Harriet was unsteady and quite dependent upon Frank Churchill for support. He guided her to a chair in the hallway, which Harriet sank gratefully into, and immediately fainted.
Goodness! Harriet! Harriet!
She will recover in a moment.
I've never seen her faint before.
Miss Smith?
I'm so sorry.
Are you all right?
Yes, perfectly all right. I mean, I will be.
Come to the drawing room. I shall call for tea. Can you stand?
Yes, I think so.
We shall each of us take an arm. There we are. Come now, it's not far.
A young lady who faints must be recovered. Questions must be answered and surprises be explained. Such events are very interesting, but the suspense of them cannot last long. Once they had settled Harriet in the drawing room, she soon recovered her senses and speech, and a few minutes made Emma acquainted with all that had happened.
I was walking with Miss Bickerton on the Richmond Road, which you know is normally public enough for safety, but which today brought us into alarm. We were about half a mile beyond Highbury, I suppose, when the road took a sudden turn. It became deeply shaded by elms on each side and very retired. We were some way into it when there was a broader patch of greensward by the side. We saw a party of gypsies there. A child who was on the watch came forward to beg. Miss Bickerton was excessively frightened and gave a great scream, then ran up a steep bank and called for me to follow her. I tried to follow her, but I had such terrible cramp after the dancing last night, and my first attempt to climb the bank brought on such a return of it. I was absolutely powerless and quite terrified, and I was obliged to remain in that state. Then I was assailed by half a dozen children, headed by a stout woman and a great boy, all clamorous. Immediately I promised them money. I took out my purse, gave them a shilling, and begged them not to want more or to use me ill. I was then able to walk, though, but slowly, and was moving away, but my terror and my purse were too tempting, and I was followed, or rather surrounded, by the whole gang demanding more. It was in this state that Mr. Churchill found me.
And right glad I was that I was passing by.
I cannot quite comprehend that you were passing just at the critical moment.
It was only by a most fortunate chance that I was there at all. My leaving Highbury had been delayed. I happened to have borrowed a pair of scissors of Miss Bates last night. I had forgotten to restore them, so I was obliged to stop at her door and go in for a few minutes. I set off from there, but the pleasantness of the morning had induced me to walk a while and leave my horses to meet me by another road a mile or two beyond Highbury. Being on foot, I was unseen by the whole party till almost close to them. Poor Miss Smith was filled with terror, but I soon frightened them off. I must say, Miss Bickerton acted with abominable folly in screaming so and leaving her poor friend behind. It was my idea to bring her to Hartfield. I thought of no other place.
I clung to Mr. Churchill with fervour the whole way. I had just strength enough to reach Hartfield before my spirits were quite overcome.
But you are much mended, and I am glad to see you well. I fear I can stay no longer, however. I have not a minute to lose if I am to meet my horses again.
Thank you, Mr. Churchill, for such generous... I cannot express how grateful...
I am only glad to have been of assistance, Miss Smith.
You could not have been more gallant, Mr. Churchill.
It was duty. Only duty. I shall leave you to the restorations of tea and the kind attentions of Miss Woodhouse. Perhaps you might also send word to Mrs. Goddard that Miss Smith is well?
Yes, of course, and I shall be sure to send notice to Mr. Knightley of there being such a set of people in the neighbourhood.
Then, all being well, I shall take my leave, Miss Woodhouse. Miss Smith.
1,000 thanks, Mr. Churchill, from us both.
Goodbye, ladies.
Such an adventure as this, a fine young man and a lovely young woman thrown together in such a way, could hardly fail of suggesting certain ideas to the coldest heart and the steadiest brain. So Emma thought, at least. It was an extraordinary thing. Nothing of the sort had ever occurred before to any young ladies in the place within her memory, and now it had happened to the very person and at the very hour when the other very person was chancing to pass by to rescue her. It certainly was very extraordinary. And knowing as she did the favourable state of mind of each at this period, it struck her the more. He was wishing to get the better of his attachment to herself, she just recovering from her mania for Mr. Elton. It seemed as if everything united to promise the most interesting consequences. It was not possible that the occurrence should not be strongly recommending each to the other. Everything was to take its natural course, however, neither impelled nor assisted. She would not stir a step nor drop a hint. There could be no harm in a scheme, however, a mere passive scheme. It was no more than a wish. Beyond it, she would on no account proceed. Within half an hour, the story was known all over Highbury. The last night's ball seemed lost in the gypsies. Poor Mr. Woodhouse trembled as he sat, and as Emma had foreseen, would scarcely be satisfied without their promising never to go beyond the shrubbery again. The gypsies did not wait for the operations of justice. They took themselves off in a hurry. The young ladies of Highbury might have walked again in safety before their panic began, and the whole history dwindled soon into a matter of little importance, but to Emma and her young nephews. In her imagination, it maintained its ground, and Henry and John were still asking every day for the story of Harriet and the gypsies, and tenaciously setting her right if she varied in the slightest particular from the original recital. A very few days had passed after Harriet's adventure when she came one morning to Emma with a small parcel in her hand. There was a seriousness in Harriet's manner which prepared her friend for something more than ordinary.
Miss Woodhouse, if you are at leisure, I have something that I should like to tell you. A sort of confession to make. And then, you know, it will be over.
Of course, Harriet. Please, go on.
I do not want to say more than is necessary. I am too much ashamed of having given way as I have done. And I dare say you understand me.
Yes, I hope I do.
How I could so long a time be imagining myself the object of Mr. Elton's affections. It seems like madness. I can see nothing at all extraordinary in him now, and I do not envy his wife in the least. I neither admire her nor envy her as I have done. She is very charming, I dare say, but I think her very ill-tempered and disagreeable. I shall never forget her look the other night. However, I assure you, Miss Woodhouse, I wish her no evil. No. Let them be ever so happy together, it will not give me another moment's pang. And to convince you that I have been speaking the truth, I am now going to destroy what I ought to have destroyed long ago, what I ought never to have kept. I will destroy it all, and it is my particular wish to do it in your presence, that you may see how rational I am grown. Cannot you guess what this parcel holds?
Not the least in the world. Did he ever give you anything?
No. I cannot call them gifts. But they are things that I have valued very much. Now, you must recollect this piece of plaster.
No, indeed I do not.
Dear me! I should not have thought it possible you could forget what passed in this very room about court plaster, one of the very last times we ever met in it. It was but a very few days before I had my sore throat. Do not you remember his cutting his finger with your new penknife and your recommending court plaster? But as you had none about you and knew I had, you desired me to supply him. And so I took mine out and cut him a piece, but it was a great deal too large. And he cut it smaller, and kept playing some time with what was left before he gave it back to me. And so then, in my nonsense, I could not help making a treasure of it. So I put it by, never to be used, and looked at it now and then as a great treat.
My dearest Harriet, you make me so ashamed. Remember it? Aye, I remember it all now. All except your saving this relic. I knew nothing of that till this moment.
Oh, I knew you would think me foolish for it.
No, Harriet, not foolish, only deeply affected. Well, go on, what else?
Here is something still more valuable. I mean, that has been more valuable, because this did really once belong to him, which the court plaster never did.
A bit of pencil.
This was really his. Do not you remember one morning? No, I dare say you do not. But one morning, I forget exactly the day, he wanted to make a memorandum in his pocketbook. It was about spruce beer. Mr. Knightley had been telling him something about brewing spruce beer, and he wanted to put it down. But when he took out his pencil, there was so little lead that he soon cut it all away, and it would not do, so you lent him another. And this was left upon the table as good for nothing. But I kept my eye on it, and as soon as I dared, caught it up and never parted with it again from that moment.
Well, go on.
Oh, that's all. I have nothing more to show you or to say, except that I am now going to throw them both into the fire, and I wish you to see me do it. It was very wrong of me, you know, to keep any remembrances after he was married. I knew it was, but had not resolution enough to part with them. Now it is all for the fire. In goes the pencil and the plaster. There they go. And there is an end, thank heaven, of Mr. Elton.
And when, thought Emma, will there be a beginning of Mr. Churchill? She had soon afterwards reason to believe that the beginning was already made, and could not but hope that the gypsy, though she had told no fortune, might be proved to have made Harriet's. About a fortnight after the alarm, during some trivial chat in the shrubbery, the topic of Mr. Churchill was raised quite undesignedly.
Well, Harriet, whenever you marry, I hope you leave space in your heart for your friends.
Oh, I shall never marry.
Never marry? This is a new resolution.
It is one that I shall never change, however.
I hope it does not proceed from... I hope it is not in compliment to Mr. Elton.
Mr. Elton, indeed. Oh, no, there are men so superior to Mr. Elton.
Harriet, I will not affect to be in doubt of your meaning. Your resolution, or rather your expectation of never marrying, results from an idea that the person whom you might prefer would be too greatly your superior in situation to think of you. Is not it so?
Oh, Miss Woodhouse, believe me, I have not the presumption to suppose. Indeed, I am not so mad. But it is a pleasure to me to admire him at a distance, and to think of his infinite superiority to all the rest of the world. With the gratitude, wonder, and veneration which are so proper in me especially.
I am not at all surprised at you, Harriet. The service he rendered you was enough to warm your heart.
Service? Oh, it was such an inexpressible obligation. The very recollection of it, and all that I felt at the time. When I saw him coming, his noble look, and my wretchedness before. Such a change. In one moment, such a change. From perfect misery to perfect happiness.
It is very natural. It is natural and it is honourable. Yes, honourable, I think, to choose so well and so gratefully. But that it will be a fortunate preference is more than I can promise. I do not advise you to give way to it, Harriet. I do not by any means engage for its being returned. Consider what you are about. Perhaps it will be wisest in you to check your feelings while you can. At any rate, do not let them carry you far, unless you are persuaded of his liking you. Be observant of him. Let his behaviour be the guide of your sensations. I give you this caution now because I shall never speak to you again on the subject. I am determined against all interference. Henceforward, I know nothing of the matter. Let no name ever pass our lips. You were very wrong before. We will be cautious now. He is your superior, no doubt, and there do seem objections and obstacles of a very serious nature. But yet, Harriet, more wonderful things have taken place. There have been matches of greater disparity. But take care of yourself. I would not have you too sanguine. Though, however it may end, be assured your raising your thoughts to him is a mark of good taste, which I shall always know how to value.
Harriet kissed her hand in silent and submissive gratitude. Emma was very decided in thinking such an attachment no bad thing for her friend. Its tendency would be to raise and refine her mind, and it must be saving her from the danger of degradation. In this state of schemes and hopes, June opened upon Hartfield. To Highbury, in general, it brought no material change. The Eltons were still talking of a visit from the Sucklings, and of the use to be made of their barouche landau. And Jane Fairfax was still at her grandmother's and likely to remain there full 2 months longer, since the return of the Campbells from Ireland was again delayed. Mr. Knightley, who for some reason best known to himself had taken an early dislike to Frank Churchill, was only growing to dislike him more. He began to suspect him of some double dealing in his pursuit of Emma. That Emma was his object appeared indisputable. Everything declared it. His own attentions, his father's hints, his mother-in-law's guarded silence, all told the same story. But while so many were devoting Frank to Emma, and Emma herself making him over to Harriet, Mr. Knightley began to suspect him of some inclination to trifle with Jane Fairfax. He could not understand it, but there were symptoms of intelligence between them. He thought so, at least. and symptoms of admiration on his side. The suspicion first arose when he was dining with the Randalls family and Jane at the Eltons, and he had seen a look, more than a single look, at Miss Fairfax, which, from the admirer of Miss Woodhouse, seemed somewhat out of place. When he was again in their company, it brought him yet stronger suspicion of there being a something of private liking, of private understanding even, between Frank Churchill and Jane. He had walked up one day after dinner, as he very often did, to spend his evening at Hartfield. Emma and Harriet were going to walk. He joined them, and on returning they fell in with a larger party, Mr. and Mrs. Weston and their son, Miss Bates and her niece, who had accidentally met. They had all judged it wisest to take their exercise early, as the weather threatened rain. They united, and on reaching Hartfield's gates, Emma, who knew it was exactly the sort of visiting that would be welcome to her father, pressed them all to go in and drink tea with them. As they were turning into the grounds, Mr. Perry passed by on horseback. The gentleman spoke of his horse, which gave Frank Churchill a beginning to his next conversation.
By the by, Mrs. Weston, what became of Mr. Perry's plan of setting up his carriage?
I did not know that he ever had any such plan.
Nay, I had it from you. You wrote me word of it 3 months ago.
Me? Impossible.
Indeed you did. I remember it perfectly. You mentioned it as what was certainly to be very soon. Mrs. Perry had told somebody and was extremely happy about it. It was owing to her persuasion, as she thought his being out in bad weather did him a great deal of harm. You must remember it now.
Upon my word, I never heard of it till this moment.
Never? Really, never? Bless me, how could it be? Then I must have dreamt it.
So, Perry is going to set up his carriage, Frank. Oh, I'm glad he can afford it. You had it from himself, had you?
No, Papa, I seem to have had it from nobody. Very odd. I really was persuaded of Mrs. Weston's having mentioned it in one of her letters to Enscombe many weeks ago, but as she declares, she never heard a syllable of it before. Of course, it must have been a dream. I am a great dreamer. I dream of everybody at Highbury when I'm away, and when I've gone through my particular friends, then I begin dreaming of Mr. and Mrs. Perry.
Well, Frank, your dream certainly shows that Highbury is in your thoughts when you are absent. Emma, you are a great dreamer, I think.
Emma was out of hearing. She had hurried on before her guests to prepare her father for their appearance and was beyond the reach of Mr. Weston's hint. Miss Bates took advantage of the moment's pause to pronounce her thoughts on the subject.
There is no denying that Mr. Frank Churchill might have... I do not mean to say that he did not dream it. I am sure I have sometimes the oddest dreams in the world. But if I am questioned about it, I must acknowledge that there was such an idea last spring, for Mrs. Perry herself mentioned it to my mother, and the Coles knew of it as well as ourselves. But it was quite a secret, known to nobody else, and only thought of about 3 days. At the same time, I will not positively answer for my having never dropped a hint, because I know I do sometimes pop out a thing before I am aware. I am a talker, you know. I am rather a talker.
They were entering the hall. Mr. Knightley caught Frank glancing at Jane, perhaps with meaning, but she was too busy with her shawl. They entered the drawing room and took their seats round the large, modern circular table. Frank sat beside Emma. Opposite them was Jane, and the others took their places between the two couples. Tea passed pleasantly, and nobody seemed in a hurry to move.
Miss Woodhouse, I spy the box of letters your nephews played with beside you there. We had great amusement with those letters one morning. Perhaps we can revive the tradition this evening. I'd like to puzzle you again.
An excellent idea. Papa, this is a favourite game of yours.
A lovely, gentle game indeed. Though it is a sad reminder of poor little Henry and James. They did so enjoy their alphabets with Aunt Emma and Grandpapa. I do wish they were closer to us. Oh, look, Miss Fairfax, Mr. Churchill has a word for you already.
Frank Churchill placed a word before Miss Fairfax. She gave a slight glance round the table and applied herself to it. Mr. Knightley was so placed as to see both Miss Fairfax and Frank Churchill. and it was his object to see as much as he could with as little apparent observation. The word was discovered, and with a faint smile, pushed away. Harriet, eager after every fresh word and finding out none, directly took it up and fell to work. She was sitting by Mr. Knightley and turned to him for help. The word was blunder. And as Harriet exultingly proclaimed it, there was a blush on Jane's cheek, which gave it a meaning not otherwise ostensible. Mr. Knightley connected it with the dream, but how it could all be was beyond his comprehension. These letters were but the vehicle for gallantry and trick. It was a child's play chosen to conceal a deeper game on Frank Churchill's part. With great indignation did Mr. Knightley continue to observe him, with great alarm and distrust to observe also his two blinded companions. Mr. Knightley then saw a short word prepared for Emma and given to her with a look sly and demure. She appeared to find the word entertaining, but judged it proper to censure.
Nonsense, for shame!
I will give it to her. Shall I?
No, you must not. You shall not indeed.
It was done, however. This gallant young man, who seemed to Mr. Knightley to love without feeling and to recommend himself without complacence, directly handed over the word to Miss Fairfax. Mr. Knightley's excessive curiosity to know what this word might be made him seize every possible moment for darting his eye towards it, and it was not long before he saw it to be Dixon. Jane was evidently displeased. She looked up and, seeing herself watched, blushed deeply. She pushed away the letters with an angry spirit and turned towards her aunt.
I did not know that proper names were allowed.
Very true, my dear. Well, I think it is time for us to be going indeed. The evening is closing in, and Grandmama will be looking for us. My dear Mr. Woodhouse, you are too obliging. We really must wish you a good night.
Mr. Knightley remained at Hartfield after all the rest, his thoughts full of what he had seen. He must, as an anxious friend, give Emma some hint, ask her some question. He could not see her in a situation of such danger without trying to preserve her. It was his duty. When Mr. Woodhouse had retired and they were quite alone, Mr. Knightley raised the topic at last.
Pray, Emma, may I ask in what lay the great amusement, the poignant sting of the last word given to you and Miss Fairfax? I saw the word, and am curious to know how it could be so very entertaining to the one and so very distressing to the other.
Oh, it all meant nothing. A mere joke among ourselves.
The joke seemed confined to you and Mr. Churchill? My dear Emma, do you think you perfectly understand the degree of acquaintance between the gentleman and lady we've been speaking of?
Between Mr. Frank Churchill and Miss Fairfax?
Oh, yes, perfectly.
Why do you make a doubt of it?
Have you never at any time had reason to think that he admired her, or that she admired him?
Never, never. Never for the 20th part of a moment did such an idea occur to me. And how could it possibly come into your head?
I've lately imagined that I saw symptoms of attachment between them, certain expressive looks, which I did not believe were meant to be public.
You amuse me excessively. I am delighted to find that you can let your imagination wander, but it will not do. There is no admiration between them, I do assure you. The appearances which have caught you have arisen from some peculiar circumstances. It is impossible exactly to explain, but they are as far from any attachment or admiration for one another as any two beings in the world can be. That is, I presume it to be so on her side, and I can answer for its being so on his.
She spoke with a confidence which staggered Mr. Knightley. She was in gay spirits and would have prolonged the conversation, wanting to hear all the wheres and hows of a circumstance which highly entertained her, but his gaiety did not meet hers. He found he could not be useful, and his feelings were too much irritated for talking. That he might not be irritated into an absolute fever by the fire which Mr. Woodhouse's tender habits required almost every evening throughout the year, He soon afterwards took a hasty leave and walked home to the coolness and solitude of Donwell Abbey. The following days brought a mixed set of news to the Highbury world. At Randall's, it was all felicity. Mrs. Weston was expecting a child, and her happiness was matched by that of all her neighbours. The Eltons, meanwhile, received the mortifying news that Mr. and Mrs. Suckling, whom they spoke of so often, could not possibly come till the autumn. Mrs. Elton was very much disappointed at first, but a little consideration convinced her that everything need not be put off. Why should not they explore to Box Hill, though the Sucklings did not come? They could go there again with them in the autumn. It was settled that they should go to Box Hill. Various schemes were arranged. Mrs. Elton would visit with her party, and Emma, still curious to see Box Hill but not by any means with Mrs. Elton, persuaded Mr. Weston into a separate party. Mr. Weston's goodwill won out, however. He invited one and all. Mrs. Elton had very readily acceded to it. Emma found herself therefore obliged to consent to an arrangement which she would have done a great deal to avoid. The day for exploring was almost settled when a lame carriage horse threw everything into sad uncertainty. No preparations could be ventured on before the horse was usable again, and it was all melancholy stagnation. Mrs. Elton's resources were inadequate to such an attack, and she spoke most feelingly of it to Mr. Knightley when they were united at Randall's.
Is not this most vexatious, Knightley? And such weather for exploring! These delays and disappointments are quite odious. What are we to do?
Well, you had better explore to Donwell. That may be done without horses. Come and eat the strawberries. They're ripening fast.
If Mr. Knightley did not begin seriously, he was obliged to proceed so, for his proposal was caught at with delight. Donwell was famous for its strawberry beds, which seemed a plea for the invitation, but no plea was necessary. Cabbage beds would have been enough to tempt the lady, who only wanted to be going somewhere. She named herself Lady Patroness and asked only for a carte blanche to invite guests of her choosing. Mr. Knightley politely refused. He could only trust one woman with such a task, and that was Mrs. Knightley, when she existed.
Oh, you are an odd creature. Well, I shall bring Jane with me, Jane and her aunt. The rest I leave to you. It is to be a morning scheme, you know, quite a simple thing. It is to be all out of doors, a table spread in the shade, you know. Everything as natural and as simple as possible. Is not that your idea?
Not quite. My idea of the simple and the natural will be to have the table spread in the dining room. The nature and the simplicity of gentlemen and ladies with their servants and furniture, I think, is best observed by meals within doors.
Mr. Knightley had another reason for avoiding a table in the shade. He wished to persuade Mr. Woodhouse, as well as Emma, to join the party, and he knew that to have any of them sitting down out of doors to eat would inevitably make Mr. Woodhouse ill. He was invited on good faith and did consent. Mr. Knightley was fortunate in everybody's most ready concurrence. Emma and Harriet professed very high expectations of pleasure from it, and Mr. Weston, unasked, promised to get Frank over to join them if possible, a proof of gratitude which could have been dispensed with. Under a bright midday sun at almost midsummer, Mr. Woodhouse was safely conveyed in his carriage and in one of the most comfortable rooms in the abbey, especially prepared for him by a fire all the morning. He was happily placed in the company of Mrs. Weston, who seemed to have walked there on purpose to be tired and sit all the time with him. There they remained while all the others were invited or persuaded out. It was so long since Emma had been at the Abbey that as soon as she was satisfied of her father's comfort, she was glad to leave him and look around her, eager to gain a more exact understanding of a house and grounds which must ever be so interesting to her and all her family. She felt all the honest pride and complacency which her alliance with the present and future proprietor could fairly warrant, as she viewed the respectable size and style of the building, its ample gardens stretching down to meadows washed by a stream, and its abundance of timber in rows and avenues, which neither fashion nor extravagance had rooted up. The house was larger than Hartfield, and totally unlike it, rambling and irregular, with many comfortable rooms and one or two handsome rooms. It was just what it ought to be, and Emma felt an increasing respect for it as the residence of a family of such true gentility, untainted in blood and understanding. Some faults of temper John Knightley had, but Isabella had connected herself unexceptionably with such a fine family. These were pleasant feelings, and she walked about and indulged them till it was necessary to do as the others did and collect round the strawberry beds. The whole party were assembled, excepting Frank Churchill, who was expected every moment from Richmond. Mrs. Elton, in all her apparatus of happiness, her large bonnet and her basket, was very ready to lead the way in gathering, accepting, or talking. Strawberries, and only strawberries, could now be thought or spoken of. Such, for half an hour, was the conversation, until the party was ready for shade. Mr. Knightley guided them to a pleasant spot beneath an oak tree. Emma, finding herself seated near Mrs. Elton and Jane Fairfax, was obliged to overhear what they were talking of. A situation, a most desirable situation, was in question. Mrs. Elton had received notice of it that morning and was in raptures.
It is with an acquaintance of Mrs. Suckling, a delightful lady, and the situation most charming and suitably superior for your talents. You would mix in the first circles, the highest spheres. It is just the situation we have been looking for. Do not thank me, Jane. Your appointment shall be satisfaction enough.
Mrs. Elton, you are too kind, really.
Nonsense.
I owe you a great debt for thinking of me, but...
Really, Jane, you need not be nervous. It is an elevated situation, to be sure, but with my recommendation...
Mrs. Elton, I shall not at present engage in anything. I am awaiting the return of the Campbells in the autumn. I shall not stir till then.
But, my dear girl, you know...